listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY
Musician
Podcast. Hey there, and welcome to episode 192 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
You know, honestly, I'm actually scared to say how I'm doing.
Why? Why is that, Chris? Why are you so scared?
If you recall, on the last episode, I had a artistic confession that I was making, and it seems that it stirred a strong response in some listeners who basically didn't care and wanted us just to get to the meat of the episode. So yeah, I don't know. Well, I'm fine. I'll leave it there. I'm friggin' fine.
You're doing better. All right, your time's up. We have time limits on these things now.
All right, let's move to the
we had some other folks that had some positive comments about your artistic confession that we'll get to a little bit later. But I did want to highlight one thing that we do tend to get some comments now and again, and it's usually when the podcast gets featured in our newsletter, our CD Baby newsletter, which means that we're drawing in a bunch of new listeners who maybe haven't heard the podcast before. The reason Chris and I have this little banter section at the beginning, one is I'm in Portland and he's in Maine, and this is the only time we get to talk to each other, so just deal with that. but the real reason is Chris and I have our own musical pursuits going, and this podcast was started as a community type event or a community gathering. It's a sharing of information, and I want everyone listening to know that we're real artists trying real things, have our own struggles, have our own successes, and that's all a part of the podcast in bringing an authenticity to the information we share. So that's why we like to let you know what's going on. I find it interesting when, for the podcast, I listen to about a certain subject to know that the people who are telling me stuff actually have some authority on the subject matter and are doing things in that field. So that's why we do it.
Yeah, it's like when, you know, when I'm writing something for CD Baby and I want to express that, like, you know, most of the people that work at CD Baby are artists. Like, you know, it seems like a cliche in one sense because a lot of music companies are also, you know, artists or former artists, but it's like, we get it. We care. Like, so I guess this is that version of that for the podcast.
Yeah, we're in the trenches as well. The one thing that's always frustrated me in the music space is how quickly artists are willing to just listen to anybody who tells them something. And a lot of times that leads to that the person who is the authority, in air quotes, asking for the artist to pay up for some services or something. And not that that's always bad, but it's just a matter of there's a lot of people out there that have never been artists. They don't know what it's like to be an artist. There's a lot more motivations for an artist career than just money. And so I think it's important that you hear the real life scenarios Chris and I find ourselves in that help bring validity to what we're saying. And speaking of that, Chris, I got an interesting phone call yesterday.
Oh, I'm intrigued.
I got to work and I got a phone call from a licensing company that has Hello Morning. If you've been a long time listener to the podcast, you know that I was in a band called Hello Morning here in Portland. We did a couple albums and we've had a few placements over the years for it. But I got a call yesterday saying that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame had licensed a couple tracks.
I saw a tweet about that. Yeah.
For usage in a new installation at their museum. So
that's awesome.
I hope it's not an installation for bands that totally never met their potential or something like that.
Or music that tries to position itself as rock music but isn't.
Yeah. Or all the copycat bands that tried to copy X band, you know. I don't know. they didn't tell me what the installation was, but I just know that it was some new installation they're putting in the museum. They licensed the music for two tracks, and I guess they'll also be in usage on the website. And the fee that they paid was similar to, like, for each song was similar to like an independent level TV spot. So I'm assuming it wasn't like they licensed thousands of tracks. They probably licensed a handful of tracks and ours being a couple of them. So that was cool. This, I can now say that some of my music's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, congrats.
It might be in, you know, it could also be in the bathroom. They may be extending the wing of the bathroom in the new installation.
That's the installation, yeah, the toilet.
But hey, either way, what it's in the building.
Nice.
So that was a cool thing that happened.
And so I just have a question about that. You have four or five co-writers in the band?
Four.
So you have to use CD Baby's publishing split sheet that we're going to post any week now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. You be looking for that. Chris put together this handy songwriter publishing split sheet that will help you make sure that all the information is well documented for each song, so there's no questions 2, 3, 4, 5 years later when something happens with your music. Which I will point out, these Hello Morning tracks, that album came out in 2011, and that's one of the things that made me love sync licensing and just where music is going in general, especially in a streaming world as well, that release dates no longer matter. If it's a good track, it can find success at any time. So that's why it's so important that you have your whole catalog out there and don't go, oh, that album's 3 years old, I'm pulling it down. Because you're just immediately eliminating any possible future success for that music, because if it doesn't exist out in the world, then it doesn't exist. But with that being said, we got a lot of stuff to talk about today. We've got we're kind of combining the news and the topic for today, and we're going to be talking about these alleged fake artists that Spotify is creating in order to screw other artists, as so the conspiracy theories go. We'll be discussing that in the news section, and that'll kind of be our main topic. And then we have a lot of listener comments, emails, and calls, and feedback. So it's going to be a action-packed show. Lots of different things will be discussed.
The fake artists and the real questions.
Yeah, that's right. We're calling this episode "Fake Artist Controversies and the Real Artist Questions." So it's kind of a two-parter. But before we get to all that, I want to remind you to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or subscribe on your podcatcher app, and make sure you don't miss an episode. We're cranking out a lot more episodes these days. Just be sure to subscribe and you won't miss an episode. And speaking of the banter at the front, if it's boring, irritating, or you just want to get past it, all of these apps have a fast forward button that comes in handy. And I'm not saying that to be snarky. I use it sometimes myself. And it just, you know, they're handy. It gets you through certain things faster. And yeah, if you just despise what Chris and I have to say, that's your ticket. And the final thing I would also say as an update, because we talked about it in last episode, the DIY Musician Conference in Nashville is sold out. So I hope you got a ticket. It's sold out. And no more tickets available. Can't wait to see everybody in Nashville. All right, Chris, let's get to the news.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
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 News.
Well, like I said, for this news section, we're going to do things a little different. It's kind of our main topic as well, but it's sort of this tour of news, all related to the Spotify fake artist controversy. So if you haven't been paying attention to the music news, there has been a lot of talk in the last couple weeks about these alleged fake artists on Spotify. So we're just going to walk through it sort of development by development, because I think it's interesting and points to how streaming music is potentially different. And I think hopefully we'll debunk some myths, continue the debunking of myths as we did in last episode. But here we go. So this is from Music Business Worldwide, This article actually posted last year. So this the beginning of this controversy, the seeds of it have been out there for a while. And I'm going to just read a portion of that article. The title of the article was Spotify is making its own records and putting them on playlists. So that was the title of the article. And the section I'm going to read is multiple cast iron sources have informed us that in recent months, Daniel X Company has been paying producers to create tracks within specific musical guidelines. We're also hearing that these producers receive a flat fee for their work, in addition to studio and musician expenses. But Spotify holds on to the master copyright. The subsequent track appear on Spotify under fake artist names. These fake artists are credited on Spotify with owning their own master rights. But they don't, because they're made up people. So that's the initial controversy that was started. Some interesting nuggets in there that I think we should discuss at some point. But the statement I find funny is these fake artists are credited on Spotify with owning their master rights, but they don't. Doesn't that describe every artist that's on a label?
Right, exactly. And these fake artists are actually real artists who have made the music. They just happen to have a pseudonym, just like Bob Dylan.
So we're getting to that. We're getting to that. So,
oh, all right. Okay.
Yeah, we've got a whole. It's all unfolding. So get your tinfoil hat out, Chris. We've got some places to go. So the controversy kind of kicked up again last week. There was a very large article that appeared on Vulture.com, and the title of the article was "The Streaming Problem: How Spammers, Superstars, and Tech Giants Gamed the Music Industry." It's an interesting article. That headline sounds very nefarious, but some of it is just pointing to how streaming is different than a download world or a CD world, a world where there's music that can exist and can be useful, but isn't necessarily music that is an album that you're going to go put on and listen to. Like, they reference Matt Farley, who is a CD Baby artist, who he's the one, we've talked about him on the podcast before. He's the one that has like 30,000 versions of Happy Birthday, all on Spotify. Mm-hmm.
And he's probably listening. I think he listens to most episodes.
Yeah, he does listen to the podcast. And there's, so they reference things like that, people flooding Spotify with Happy Birthday songs, or the band, it was a couple years ago where they did a silent album. And Spotify ended up paying like $20,000 before they shut it down because there was no music there. So some of it's talking about those things, how streaming is dealing with some of those issues. And for complete transparency's sake, here at CD Baby, we've seen that happen with every format. People have tried to game the system. So it's not a thing that only is unique to streaming. Every format, people have tried to do things to game the system. But the interesting thing that this article brings up the idea of the fake artist again, and that's what got the whole thing, everyone up in arms all over again. And I'm going to read a quote from that article, and they're talking about playlists being so important, and so that's what they're talking about at this point in the article when they say this. That means that songs on playlists generally get tons of plays. It's why there are countless articles providing tips on how a band can get their music on a playlist. It's also why Spotify is allegedly paying producers to create fake artists whose music can rack up plays without costing the company any more than what they paid up front. This won't work for the Everyday Favorites playlist, of course. People expect to have heard the artists on that one. It's with the many popular instrumental playlists that this strategy succeeds. Take Ambient Chill, which has 406,000 followers and is grouped with other instrumental playlists as focus music. The first song on the playlist is by composer Max Richter. The second is by an unknown band called Deep Watch, which has two songs on Spotify, each with more than a million streams. The first song on Sleep, a playlist of calming instrumental tracks with 1.5 million followers, is by Eno Ere, a band with three songs on Spotify and no footprint out of the streaming service. The band Evolution of the Stars has only two songs on Spotify, but both are on the Deep Focus playlist and have combined 15 million streams. So in this article, they're pointing out, they're taking it to the next level and not just saying that Spotify is creating these fake artists, but they're saying, hey, look, there's these artists that have three tracks and they're featured on all these key playlists that are getting tons of streams. That seems suspicious. And they are, you know, in this article, go on to say that they're robbing people of these slots. And it's especially in these instrumental, you know, there's a lot of chill playlists, yoga playlists that these things seem to be showing up in. So that came out a couple weeks ago. And then in Digital Music News, there was an article where Spotify officially responds and says, we do not and have never created fake artists and put them on Spotify playlists. Categorically untrue, full stop. We pay royalties, sound, and publishing for all tracks on Spotify and for everything we playlist. We do not own rights, we're not a label, and all our music is licensed from rights holders and we pay them. We don't pay ourselves. Because part of the controversy was they were saying that Spotify was doing this to own the music outright, and so that music being used in the system wouldn't generate royalties. And it was a way for them to skim some royalties, allegedly. That's what people were saying.
Sure, and I don't know if you're going to comment on this later, but another aspect of that is that if you're... Because what Spotify pays out to rights holders is a percentage of revenue, the more plays that are happening by these, quote, fake artists, the less money per stream is getting paid to everyone else.
Correct. But with the millions and millions and millions of tracks on Spotify and the billions and billions and billions of plays, it would take really a catalog the size of CD Baby's of alleged fake artists in order to really make a dent in those plays. If they're saying this is only for artists, you know, recognizable artists, clearly they can't do anything about that. But these genres where, you know, you get mood music and things where it's less about the artist and more just the music, you would really have to flood the market in order to make significant impact to their bottom line, if that was their intent.
Mm-hmm.
So then the follow-up is all the people that were being labeled fake artists got pissed. And it turns out that some of these production companies, there's one of them, let's see where they are. I'm going to say they're in a Swedish company called Epidemic Sound. It's a music production company, and a bunch of the alleged fake artists were people from companies like this writing under a pseudonym, and that they were getting upset that, hey, we're not fake artists. This is real music. We just put it under a different name because we write all different styles of music. And that's something we've even talked about on the podcast.
Well, I have my tinfoil hat on now, so I'll just say that that company, though, is owned by an investor in Spotify.
True, but that's not the only company that they've
contracted.
Used. Well, that's the thing. It's as you read deeper and deeper, that the idea of them contracting to do this was really more of an accusation and not something that was true. But the funny thing is that this piece brought up, to me, it started to highlight, what are they calling a fake artist? What really is an artist? What constitutes an artist on Spotify as legitimate? We have artists that have released one or two tracks that have millions of plays because they released one or two tracks that are really good and they had a marketing strategy or some sort of strategy to get it pitched to somebody who put it someplace prominent. They don't necessarily, doesn't mean they're touring. They may not even have a website. It's and the real sort of thing that this particular article points to, where the artists were like, hey, we're not fake, is that in a streaming world, production music has different value than it maybe was thought to have had in the past.
Right. And then to bring the pseudonym thing in, I mean, plenty of famous artists have had pseudonyms, but someone like Matt Farley, who, you know, releases music under probably 30 different band names, it's not production music exactly, but he's creating music for a purpose, you know, like the Happy Birthday song, or yeah, that's kind of an equivalent of the yoga music or the chill focus music. It's like, that doesn't take away from its legitimacy. It just means that major label people are pissed off because it's not Drake.
Yeah. Well, and if you're not familiar with the idea of library music or production music, it's something that we hear probably more so than anything else in some cases in our lives, depending on how much TV you watch and how much you're at places like the mall or shopping centers. There's giant catalogs that are made with the sole purpose of just being background music in TV and film. These are the scenes where the music is pretty inconsequential. It's not playing prominently, it's not super recognizable, but they need some music in the background. It's not something the composer, like a big name composer, is doing. So that music gets used a ton. And so this article is kind of pointing out that the idea of that this music's finding its way on Spotify, and it actually has value on Spotify, but it challenges the notion of what is considered a real artist. If you're not on a label, if you're not someone out touring or trying to build an identity of that artist, that it's fake music. But at the same time, it's like, I even have my own project where I've got a different artist name that I'm going to release some instrumental music on. Probably be 70 by the time I finish any of it. But but it's like, under their definition of fake artist, that would fall under fake artist. So it's just kind of interesting. And rounding it out, the final thing that came out about this on Digital Music News, and in fact, they were saying the New York Times revealed why Spotify will never be like Netflix, because Netflix has created a bunch of content they own. And so a lot of these fake artists were considered to be Spotify trying to own content so they can keep that share and not have to pay out more royalties, like you mentioned. And it came out that in the terms that Spotify has with Warner Brothers, Sony, and Universal, that Spotify is not allowed to own content under their current agreement with the majors. So they couldn't even own it in the first place if they wanted to. So this whole controversy has been a lot of nothing. And it's just, again, one of those things where people are quick in the streaming world to try and burn it down, say everything's rigged, question what's happening. And then when you look a little deeper, it's just really points to the fact that a streaming world is different, and that the kind of music that has value is different. Now, did Spotify approach those companies and say, hey, we really need more of this type of music, will you compose some of this music? Who knows? But the thing that's important to note in all of this, no one ever questioned the validity of these artists. No one ever said these are crappy songs that are getting placed and don't belong here. There was no problem with that at all. In fact, those songs have some big followings. A lot of the fake artists in question have big followings on Spotify and tons of plays. So clearly people like the music.
Well, yeah, and Spotify used that as a kind of part of their rebuttal. They said, you know, nothing that's in these playlists is there because we're forcing it to be there. Kind of, you know, they were making the case that everything sort of is merit based and it's all based on user data and user preferences. And like, I think the end result matches that statement, but I would also believe that, you know, if that production house is owned by so-and-so that invests in Spotify, there's probably plenty of personal relationships between those companies, and an editor from Spotify might have been like, oh, you created this chill track, I'm gonna just put it in this playlist and see how it does. Now, if everyone skipped that track on the first day, I do believe they would downgrade it or, you know, take it out of the playlist. But, you know, so I'm basically, yes, I think it is merit-based, but that's not necessarily the starting point. That would be my suspicion.
I would say that's probably true. And that always comes back to the music business is still a relationship business. There's lots of ways you can game things online. There's lots of tricks and marketing tricks you can learn that are all very helpful. But at the end of the day, when it comes down to getting a gig, getting press, getting placed on a playlist, there's still relationship is king. And if you haven't figured that out, you need to. And that's why on the podcast, we talk about it so often, about the way you communicate with people, the way I see artists emailing music professionals just drives me crazy. They send things that are like a text message or no context or broken sentences, bad grammar and no punctuation, or they write a book. All these things ensure that nobody, you're not building relationships, and building relationships is key. So
we need to do an episode sometime called Get Out of the Basement.
Get out of the basement.
Because that's the other thing. Forget about how you're communicating. A lot of people don't even want to try in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. It is scary to put yourself out there. So the whole, you know, I thought it was interesting. This whole Spotify thing was unfolding the last 2 weeks after we did the last episode about streaming myths debunked. And I thought it was worthy of discussing a little bit further, just because these fake artists were real people making good music that people wanted to listen to, but it's just challenging the idea of what is a real artist. In my mind, these production companies, the way they're wired is they look for needs in the marketplace. That's how they create music for film and TV. It's like, what kind of music is going to be used in film and TV? What are the background needs? What's the kind of music that's going to be licensed by shopping centers, by websites, by all these people that need music that's not a featured artist? And they make it. And so to me, a big piece of it is that those same folks were looking at the streaming world and saw that streaming services are not just about featured performers, star power, artists and their fans. It's about music being useful in certain scenarios, whether it be workout music, it be meditation music, yoga music, which is huge on Spotify. And I think they looked at what made a good track in those instances and made one, and then probably leaned on some relationships to get some placements.
Yeah, I mean, as I've read all of these, new chapters in this particular controversy, I have to say, almost every quote from like someone representing a major label just struck me as like, you just have your feelings hurt that you're not as, maybe this might be harsh, but basically it's like, you just have your feelings hurt that you're not in control of this. You have your feelings hurt that this is attention and listenership that's being taken away from your superstars. You just hate that this is a new thing. And like all of this anger, and it does feel a little conspiracy theorist based on the fact that their grip is slipping a little bit.
They're definitely losing power. I mean, it's like, not only have they lost power, but it's like, you know, it's funny. I was reading an interview last night of the A&R guy that signed Guns N' Roses. And it was interesting, like how he had to go basically put his entire career on the line, went to the president of the company, David Geffen, and said, give me this cash, huge advance. The record didn't come out for a year and a half later. Put his, you know, all this reputation on the line, and it works. So now he's this hero and this iconic A&R guy. And I think that world just doesn't matter anymore. It's You have, anyone can put music out and reach segments of the market on their own merit, and they don't need these guys to champion a band and put their career on the line. You know, it's still, I think there's a big need, if you're thinking about A&R, of people that can help develop artists, people that can take someone with talent and help them develop their talent beyond. But it's these tastemakers that sit up there going, I'm so smart because I knew which band in the Sunset Strip clubs. And by Sunset Strip clubs, I don't mean strip clubs. I mean
clarification. Yeah,
I mean Sunset Strip in Hollywood, where all the rock clubs are, which in the 80s, it was like these guys who would walk around like they are kings, deciding who they were going to, you know, pluck from the masses and make famous. And that was the game back then. And those people just don't matter. And I feel like those people are still dealing with the fact that that world is over.
You've also got me wondering now if there is a Sunset Strip club. Probably not anymore.
It's Sunset Strip is...
I haven't been there in about 6 years, I think.
It's not as seedy as it used to be. It used to be pretty rough. Now all the hipsters have moved in. I mean, Hollywood is just a bunch of hipsters now. It's sad.
See, you want to go back to the 80s too.
There was some interesting thing in the 80s. I do like the pre-internet era of music, just some of the you know, the way things worked. But I love the where we're at now, too. Can I live in both places at once? That's all I ask. All right. We would love to hear feedback, comments, calls about this whole Spotify fake artist controversy, what your thoughts are, what constitutes a real artist, what how the playing field is totally different in a streaming world. And that's a lot of times why we want, a lot of the reason why we wanted to talk about the streaming myth debunked in the last episode, because it's understanding these platforms and how they work differently can be a strategy for your success. I'll put a link to some of the articles I mentioned on the show notes. But if you want to weigh in, you can call us at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or you can just leave a comment in the show notes at cdbabypodcast.com. We've been getting a lot of emails lately. We've had some phone calls. Always can use more phone calls. And we've had a bunch of comments on the podcast site. So some good activity, and we had questions piling up, so we wanted to take a good chunk of time to answer a lot of these great questions you guys have been sending in. So we will be doing that right now. So Chris, several people commented on your confessional in a positive way.
Okay, that's all I want to hear. I don't want to hear any of the negative.
Yeah, we'll get to that. So we've got a comment about it, and we've got an email about it. So I'm gonna we'll start with that. Normally we go chunk by chunk of, like, we'll do the comments, we'll do the emails, we'll do the phone calls. But since they're related to the subject matter of what Chris should do with his life and all his songs. And it's so sad he writes so many songs. So Alonzo Soriano mentioned, I'm just going to take a section of his comment because he wrote a whole lot more that you can check out on the podcast website. But he said, I have alternate advice for Chris about his abundance of songs. Embrace it. Consistent posting is what builds a following on the interwebs. When people know there's going to be something new every Monday and Thursday, they start coming back. Be like the Johnny Cash show. You're performing instead of painstakingly crafting jewel albums. So what do you think about that?
Oh, I think that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of it like that, because I have considered posting on a schedule and just getting all these things done. And then my immediate response to that thought is like, yeah, but then they'll all have a quality of being demos in my mind. Like, I do want to just, like, if I'm going to put a song out, I want to work on it and have it be this crafted, what did he call it? A crafted jewel?
Crafting jewel albums.
Oh yeah. So like, that's what I want, but maybe that's just precious and I need to get over myself and like a decent sounding like acoustic demo. That's like just guitar and voice. Maybe that's good enough. And then like eventually the best 10 or 12 of those songs gets done with a band and that's the album or something. But I like that idea of it being the Johnny Cash show. Yeah.
The question I have with like the single song strategy is, how long does it take somebody to recognize a song is good and start enjoying it as good? I know there's songs that we hear right away and we go, I really like that. But I can't remember what I mentioned on the podcast, but I know you and I talked about it at length, and I've been wanting to do like this whole sort of deep dive into the creative process and also, when does a song become a hit song? And there's been a lot of various things that have gotten me thinking of this, but, you know, I was opening up YouTube the other day and, you know, I mentioned Guns N' Roses. So, you know, it's one of my favorite albums of all time. The Appetite for Destruction, just that raw rock energy is something that's, has hardly ever been reproduced on tape. Just that tons of energy. I've always been a big fan of Slash. But YouTube recommended me this video that was apparently the first time they ever played Sweet Child of Mine live. That guitar riff is so iconic. There's probably a few places in the world you can go that have access to music that wouldn't instantly know who that is the second that song starts. But there was probably about 50 people in the room. He starts playing that and you could hear a pin drop because nobody recognized it. And after the
not a pin drop moment, as in everyone was hushed by the brilliance. They were just indifferent, right?
Yeah, they were indifferent. They hadn't heard it before. And the song ends, and there's the obligatory like 30 people going, woo, just clapping. And it's just fascinating to me that this song, these people just heard, they're potentially the first people ever to hear this song that will be one of the most iconic songs in rock history. And they were kind of indifferent towards it.
Right, they didn't care at the end either.
Yeah, it wasn't like they were, when they start, you know, that whole guitar riff's going at the beginning and it was silent. And I was like, this is crazy. You can't, you know, a cover band playing that now would get a huge response.
Right. So, I mean, are you wondering that because basically you're saying if you do a song a week, you're not giving any one of those songs enough time to like, to just percolate with an audience and to promote it up to and then following and the video. And if it's all a campaign around a song that lasts a month or 3 months, you're giving your audience time to fall in love with it.
Yeah, it's just, where is that line that you know a song that you believe in has lived its life and its fullest potential has been exploited and it is what it is? You know, that same album, I mentioned I read that article from an A&R person on that album. It was out 9 months and it only sold 200,000 copies. And then it exploded to be one of the fastest selling debuts of all time, selling tens of millions of copies. And you're like, what happened in that first 9 months?
Right.
And so it's just like, so tying it back to this, putting out tons and tons of content, I'm wondering how you decide what songs you put focus on, because how much time does it take to get people to like a song? And if it's just week by week, I wonder if they're starting to like more you as just an entertainer, or if they're actually finding some attachment to each individual song.
Yeah, well, and the other challenge I think for me is that, you know, I'm busy, I have a job and a kid, and so I don't have the time to work on a song for a week and work every day at it, long hours, to make it a fully produced thing. So if I committed to something like that, it really would be like everything stripped down, very folky. Not because that's how I ultimately would want it to be in a fantasy world, but like because that's just what it has to be. And then I know that although I love listening to records that are super stripped down and you know, raw in that way, I also think like, oh, here's a good song of mine. I have a groove, and like, you know what, it might be the synth hooks or the drum beat that is the thing that leads people into appreciating the song as a whole. And if all I'm offering is the strummed acoustic guitar and voice, although I still think it's a good song, like I'm missing that opportunity to connect in ways that people respond to music differently for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does it make any sense?
Oh yeah. I mean, that'd be my question as well, because for me, a lot of times it's like, the drums and bass. In fact, some of the Small Town Poet stuff we're working on right now, there's this one song that the drum and bass intro just absolutely made the song. It was a good song, but then it just took it to a whole new level that wouldn't have been experienced just hearing it on acoustic guitar. It was still a good song, but it just made it all that much better.
And I don't think a lot of people listen to music wondering, is like, that whole thing of like, can you hear a hit in a demo? Like, I don't think a lot of people can. So then suddenly I'm putting out this thing that doesn't have all the, I say trappings, but you know, all that extra stuff that.
No, the hooks, the goodness.
All the hooks, the meat. Yes.
Yeah, I made that mistake once giving somebody who was booking shows that I had personal relationship with, you know, just had known them and gotten to know them, and they were a fan of kind of what I was doing, and I shared some demos with them, and I think it actually turned them off to the accepting the final product because things were raw and in a state that the average listener's just not prepared to understand. They're not listening going, oh, I can see how this is going to be this. It's like, it is what it is to them.
Right.
Well, that was kind of a bit of a side note, but I think interesting discussion. I could talk about that stuff all day. I just find the idea of when a fan starts liking and loving a song, when that point is an interesting discussion.
Well, and it's why casual listeners fall in love with things that are constantly played on the radio, even if at first they were indifferent or even hated it.
Yep.
It's like, because you've just been brainwashed into changing your tastes.
Going along with the theme of what Chris should do with all his songs, there was another email from Bryce, and he says, "Hi guys, Chris recently mentioned his struggles with having too many songs and feeling like he's falling behind. It really hit home hard. I've been writing rock music since I was about 14, now almost 31. I've got over 100 songs written, but only 17 are currently available. I feel like at least 75% of this backlog are worth releasing, but as a solo artist, time and money for studio sessions is real tight. So I've been wondering, should new, unreleased songs be submitted to ASCAP or any PRO? CD Baby makes the process very easy when submitting for digital distribution, but what if I don't have any official recording? Can I still monetize it on YouTube or claim royalties from a live performance? Is uploading rough demo versions to SoundCloud a bad idea, or do I have to learn how to stop playing songs that haven't been recorded and just cope with my full brain, empty wallet combo?" Oh, full brain of songs, empty wallet, because he has no money after recording some stuff. "This podcast has been a godsend for me. Thank you so much for your commitment to helping starving artists like me find success." One thing I would say, you can register songs with ASCAP that don't have a recording. I haven't done that before. It's been a long time since I've registered songs with ASCAP, but I think you just add songs to your catalog. You don't have to have a recording, because there's lots of people that are ASCAP writers that aren't, that they might just be lyricists, and they write lyrics that someone else writes the music to. And you could register those songs and make performance royalties for playing them live by using their online forms to submit your set list. So you can do that. But as far as claiming stuff on YouTube, you're going to have a sound recording. It's all based on sound recording at the moment. There are some things like, you know.
Although I was wondering if he was talking about just shooting like a webcam video of him playing it, and then can he monetize that?
Well, in that case, he'd probably just monetize the video content on his channel.
And not have content ID for...
Yeah, I mean, because in order to monetize the song on YouTube, they need some sort of fingerprint. So that's going to include a recording. But if he was recording, like playing those songs on YouTube to a webcam, he could monetize it on his channel. Unless you get a really big channel, lots of following, lots of views, that's really not going to amount to much money at all. What do you think about uploading rough demos to SoundCloud?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say his last set of questions was referring back to kind of what we were just talking about. It's like that, do you put forward this creation that you know isn't like, quote, perfect, in hopes that it will reach someone, or is that something to be kind of not ashamed of? But, you know, like you were saying, like playing the demo and you felt like you turned someone off. Like, I don't think there's really a right answer to that. I guess it depends also on who your audience is. What do they want from you? What do they expect? Like, try a few. Is it working? I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think?
What I would probably try is take a handful of songs, even if it was just five, or, you know, if you can do a full album, great, and do a quality recording of them, whatever you can afford, like fully produced, what you would want it to sound like, to give the listener some context of this is what I'm going for. And then if you have some songs that are demo quality but have some production value, I think the listener can then translate some in their head because they have context. Now, there's a band that I like that I'm thinking of in my mind where their debut album was a hit. They did a follow-up that was sort of an EP that was really much lower production value. But because they had the context of the first album, a lot of people kind of translated that in their brain to understand it better. It still sounded lesser quality. But I think you gotta give them some sort of context or baseline if it is not representative of what you want to do. I don't know. I don't think that people are going to go listen to 100 demos, 100 songs with you just playing songs down on a guitar that haven't been realized the way that they need to be.
Yeah, which refers back to maybe the first caller's suggestion. Not being applicable or great for me because I don't have the time or equipment or, you know, energy to make fully realized songs every single week.
But there is a way, I just thought of this, you could turn it into a thing. Like if it was, like I've got a Tascam 4-track sitting on my desk right here. I've actually had a lot of fun with this thing. I'm hoping to do some, I've been messing around with it, hoping to release some stuff that is completely done on this 4-track. And I thought that could be a thing if you do it like, a drum machine, acoustic guitar, voice, and something else, like where there's a sort of a gimmick around it, I think that might draw people in a little bit more, like, oh, he did this completely with just four tracks and that's all he had. And interesting. It's kind of cool to hear. And so people understand the lo-fi quality.
The limitation is built into someone's understanding of it.
Well, and the limitation also becomes part of the hook that, oh, look what he did with, you know, with what little he had.
Right.
Or she had. Or they had. Whatever. So that could be part of it as well, that you're like setting the listener up to understand better what they're hearing, as opposed to like, this just sounds like low quality music.
Well, and also we're focused on this so much on the sound recording, but I imagine we'll be talking about this a lot in the future, but you could do live streaming, you know, you could do a YouTube series of web, you know, just in your bedroom. You could do a Facebook Live thing every week of, you know, here. I feel like that with the visuals and the interaction with your fans on Facebook or whatever has a little more of that context just built into it. And it's not like, hey, I'm releasing a new track every week on Spotify or whatever.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And at least you're kind of getting the songs out there in this way where you'll also probably get the feedback. You know, maybe one week your song got 30 likes and the next it got 400. And then you're like, oh, well, that song's probably one I should pay attention to and give the fuller production treatment to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's lots of ideas that if we sat here for another 2 hours, we could come up with, but we should probably move on.
All right. Enough about me.
Thanks, Bryce, for that email. A couple more comments. These relate back to the last episode where we were talking about streaming myth debunked. Drew Little, he and I had some back and forth. You know, you can go to the site, podcast site, to read it all because there were a lot of longer comments. But one of the things I wanted to pull out is that he said that they pulled their entire catalog from streaming services in 2016 and had, their biggest year ever, or a banner year of sales. And we did say in the podcast that, hey, if you find something like that that works for you, great, but I would not give that person that advice. Also, I still say that I don't necessarily think, and I don't know Drew's situation. I think he said he's coming to the conference, so maybe I'll have a chance to grab a drink with him and we can discuss further. But I would wonder if the pulling of the catalog was really the reason for having
for the banner
year.
Right.
Or the fact that because they did that, they actually focused really hard their fans on where they could get it because it was the only place they could get it. So my point being that if that was the case, you can still focus the diehard fans, the people that are listening, they're paying attention to where you want them to go and not remove your music from any of these algorithms, these people browsing, or these things that are really pushing music forward. And your casual fan that hears about you and opens up their app and then sees that you're not there and just moves on with their life. So that, I don't know the details. And he didn't say what they exactly did. So I just know that he said they moved their catalog.
And he could obviously correct us, but it could be the banner year is even just something more simple. It's that maybe they had an album that year and they didn't the year before, or maybe they're just further along in their career and have more fans, or, you know, whatever. It could be any number.
I mean, there's a lot of details that could take that. And that's why I would never at face value say, yeah, pull your catalog and just focus on that, because I don't know the details. I don't know his fans. But then, you know, we had some back and forth, and he said people like CD Baby have a reason to sell success storylines on streaming. And I should say this conversation was completely respectful. There was nothing like going back and forth where I didn't, people have different opinions. But I did highlight that CD Baby does not own any of our catalog. Artists can pull at any time, and we're not like the major labels where they have an ownership stake in Spotify. And they have major content by world-renowned artists that gives them leverage to mess with the system. We don't have that happening. We don't own the catalog. So when we get some bigger name artists or some hot sellers, it's not like we can play games with it, because we're an administrator for the artist, and we aren't here to mess with their career to better our own position.
And along those lines, I would also say yesterday I had a meeting with our VP of publishing, and we were looking at the payout reports from all of our partners. And it's definitely, definitely not the case that we have, you know, just a handful or some little, you know, popular stable of artists who are making a lot of money for Spotify, and most people aren't. Like, the payments are significant across, you know, like, it's many, many, many artists. And I know when we're talking on the podcast or if I'm writing on a blog, I tend to use Perrin Lam as an example. And if it sounds like a broken record, it's not because he's the only example. It's because we had conversations with him where he expressed that he was comfortable with us talking about how much he made. A lot of artists, I think most artists, don't want us discussing specifics about their revenue because it makes them feel icky or, you know, whatever.
Which, or they're not paying taxes and they just went on the record.
Right. So I mean, you know, kind of, I could think of tons and tons and tons of CD Baby artists who are making significant revenue from Spotify. I just harp on the same name because he gave us permission to talk about it. So,
well, and the one point I was trying to make to Drew in the comment section is that we're not trying to sell these success stories so we brainwash artists into doing something that doesn't benefit them. It's the exact opposite. There was all this fear, and like the last episode was called Streaming Myths Debunked. We don't want artists making bad choices on bad information or in spite of bad information. We want artists making educated decisions on good information. And
also to see opportunities that they might not because of that.
Yeah. So artists are coming to us all the time like, how do I make this happen or that happen? And it's like, well, what we're trying to point out is that these platforms are different. It's changing how people even perceive what listening to music means, what their options are when they listen to music, how they experience the music. And when you understand that, you understand that things have shifted. The psychology of, I'm going to walk into a store and just buy something out of a bin, which was the music business for years, is completely different than I'm going to open a program and click around and listen to some tracks that I may or may not have listened to before. There's no barrier to entry. So that's the important thing. We want to highlight that these things, these artists are finding success because they are looking, understanding what is and not being fearful of what the world is not anymore.
Well said.
You can quote me on that. But anyway, Drew, thanks for the comments and the back and forth on the comment section. I look forward to seeing you at the conference. And if I do have time, it's kind of a crazy time for me, I would be more than happy to grab a drink with you. Justine commented, and her comment was much longer as well, but I just got a little snippet. And she said, I'd rather have 5,000 streams per month on Spotify, for instance, than have 5,000 sales on iTunes and have my songs just sit in somebody's library totally ignored after 1 week. That's a disproportionate amount of sales versus interest in the actual music, and can make your popularity fan calculations way off. I loved her comment and the way she's thinking, because to me, a couple things. 5,000 streams per month isn't going to, you think, ah, oh, that's not going to amount to much, but that could be forever. 5,000 streams per month forever. And it could grow. But the idea being that in a streaming world, and this is one of the things I like the most, and I mentioned, I think, in the last episode, is that when people are listening, that's real engagement. When they buy something, they may not even listen to it. I mean, the music industry used to go crazy over the Christmas season, and a lot of new releases would come out in the Christmas season because they knew grandmas and parents and people were going to the music store and just buying the latest top releases, not knowing what it is, just giving it to their kids or their grandkids. And a lot of times those releases were never even listened to. They may have gone platinum or multi-platinum, but that doesn't mean people actually listened to it and engaged with it and liked it. Where in a streaming world, I think those are better indications that people are listening to your music. And if people are listening, then good things can happen. If they're just buying and throwing it on a shelf and ignoring it, you may have made a few bucks, but that doesn't bode well for the long haul. And the music career and the music journey is a journey that's for the long haul. if you want to see success, you got to build listeners, you got to build fans, and it's something that's you got to work at year over year as you build a catalog.
I might disagree with a little bit of what you said, but not. I don't disagree with anything behind the statement. I think though, if you were taking her comparison, saying you could sell 5,000 downloads or you could encourage 5,000 streams, selling 5,000 downloads of one song is also an impressive feat that shows you've created interest, which probably bodes well for selling more downloads and or for encouraging those fans to then stream those same songs on Spotify. You know what I mean? Like, so
oh,
it's kind of an odd comparison. And yeah, obviously, if you can have $5,000 in your pocket right now, or, you know, whatever it comes out to, $3,000 after...
Absolutely.
Apple takes
I agree with you 100%. I didn't, it was her comment, and I didn't want to alter the statement, but.
Right. But I think, though, it does get back to what's most important to most artists, I think, is engagement and appreciation, not the money. You know, both are important, but I think being heard is always the first
goal. I think her critical point was that I agree with 100%. That it's what you just said. Engagement and appreciation is the goal over money, because you can have money with zero engagement and appreciation, which means that you probably won't have a career. And there's ways that can happen. Where if you have engagement and appreciation, that means that there's a good chance you can have a career, which will bring money. And so I think that's the point she's trying to make. The math might be a little off. 5,000 streams really isn't that much compared to if you got 5,000 downloads. If you got 5,000 downloads, I'd assume you'd have hundreds of thousands of streams. So, you know, I probably would have adjusted her statement a little bit. But I think in the spirit of it, she's saying, I want people listening to my music and engaging with my music. And that's a good thing. And if they're doing that, then good things can happen. That's the point I think she's trying to make. And I agree with.
Yeah, I completely agree with that as well.
All right, let's move on. I got about 15 minutes left before I got to close this out. Connor commented back. He gave a lot more details about his situation. If you remember in the last episode of the podcast, he was talking about, you know, these guys that were trying, you know, were more interested in being more than just players. They wanted to buy in and have some investment in the band. And he goes into detail about what he's done. He says, here's his following issues. So he kind of gave me the backstory that filled in the details. I don't think there's much more new information that needs to be shared in order to understand, then, you know, basically these guys want to buy in and be more than just guys that play for him. They want to be a part of the band and be financially invested and part of it. So he said, now you have these following issues. How much do I pay the guys per show now that all but one of them have thrown money into the pool? How do I divide merch sales? Are CDs included in merch? If so, we'd have to divide the old CDs from the new since they didn't have a part of in the old. How, when do I start paying royalties? I'd like to make some money back before they start receiving royalties. However, I'm not sure what the fair amount is. If you remember, he cut them in at 10% of the songwriting and master. Do I pay guys before or after I pay my manager the 15%? He helps the band with everything, but is also my personal manager and helps with solo stuff as well. So those were some more of his questions, and saying he wants a fair agreement. He makes some money back. The guys who invested get some of their investment. We can start a band account so that no one has to put as much personal money in again. And most importantly, everyone is happy, feels it's worth their time, and it's easy to calculate. Unpacking this a little bit. First off, let's deal with the manager question. The manager always gets paid off the gross. So technically they get paid first. If you've been a long time listening to the podcast, there's been many times where I've referenced how with Small Town Poets, when we were on a label, that we were pretty much the last ones to get paid. I know I mentioned it in the keynote I did at the conference last year, and it's in that episode that we posted to the podcast feed. We were the last to get paid. And so your manager is going to get paid first. They're going to stop working for you the second you stop paying them. So if you want them to keep working for you, they're going to get paid first. As far as everything else with what Connor's been talking about, I feel like, Connor, that you're overcomplicating this. For shows, I think it doesn't matter if they're bought in or not. Just come up with a set amount that people get paid for shows. Everyone's having to show up and practice. Everyone's having to show up and do the show, take time out. just make up a general across the board. This is what happens at a show. It doesn't matter who it is. If someone leaves the band and you replaced them, that person would get this same benefit because everyone's having to show up and do that. As far as the recordings and such, I would say that you should always pay off debts and things that were cost of doing the business first, and then people benefit. That's part of being an owner. If people can't agree to it, then maybe they decide that they're not really all in.
Well, and sort of acting as a label, it's almost like recouping before anyone gets paid, and it's just like you happen to be the label, so you're going to recoup all of your investment. And then at that point, once you've broken even, then you start divvying up profit in whatever way you've decided, percentages or you know, whatever. But
yeah, and even the merch sales, like talking about, should they get money from this CD or that, just pool it all. It's merch sales. It's all money that keeps the thing going. Maybe you decide, this is the only thing I might say, depending on your situation, maybe you decide that, hey, half of the merch sales go directly back to paying off expenses, and half we split, or what I, you know, in every situation I've been, all the merch sales have just gone into paying off expenses. And, you know, if we've paid everything off and we had merch money and we had show money, we just kind of split it. Also, it could be that, hey, if these guys go back to the table and actually hustle and sell merch, yeah, maybe there's a reason, a way to incentivize people. But if you get too tricky and fancy, to me, that's just setting things up to just be in a constant state of somebody's unhappy. Because
it needs, and a headache to keep track of.
Yeah, because if it's so complicated to keep track of, then someone's going to get their feelings hurt saying they didn't get compensated fairly. People are going to get their feelings hurt even if you make it the easiest straightforward agreement. So just, I think, simplify, come up with a way to compensate people for the show. Figure out how the money will flow, that merch money and record sales and things like that, in order to pay back expenses. And know that your manager is going to take 15% of the gross. So you got to account for that when it all pools together anyway.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, like, what a nightmare it would be if he's factoring in mechanicals on the CDs that are sold, and suddenly, not, you know, let's say they sell a disc for $10 or whatever. Now he's got to get, you know, siphon off the mechanicals into its own little account, then figure out how they're divvying up whatever for the CD sale, and then how he's cutting them all in on 10% of publishing, so then that little mechanical fund has to get all divvied up. It sounds awful.
Yeah.
I mean, until, I guess, you're making, I don't know, maybe they are already making serious money, but that stuff seems to become more important later. And now I'm rethinking my advice, though, because you don't want to get into a situation when there's real, real money later, like people are getting pissed because they're getting cut out of something.
Yeah, I think you need to make it clear. There's a lot of different ways bands have dealt with, like, the songwriting issue in that particular case. I know a band that became very popular that the way they had their songwriter thing set was that a fourth of the songwriting money went to the band as a whole. So everyone who was in the band got a piece of that. So even if you were a non-writer, non-real contributor, but you were an official band member, you still got a tiny slice of the overall songwriting pie just because you helped kind of bring those songs forth in some capacity. Then, like, a quarter went to who wrote the lyrics and who wrote the music. And so there's ways bands do it. Other bands just go, nope, you didn't write the songs. I mean, this is how it is in Small Town Poets. It's like the only people credited for the songwriting, the actual songwriting, are those who actually contributed to the songwriting. So there's a lot of songs I don't have any songwriting credit on, even though there might be guitar hooks and things like that that help the song. That's where there's, you know, there could be debate on how people treat that. Like with Hello Morning, it was just the four of us. We were all there. We just split it four ways equally. So there's different ways people do it. The best thing is just to be open and honest about it.
And not cause yourself accounting headaches, because yeah. That is going to get old real fast if you're settling up every month.
Yes. All right. We are going to finish up with a phone call. Here we go.
Hi, guys. This is Leroy Mobley. And my life goal is to be like a world touring, like stadium headlining pop artist. I know it's going to take a little while, but I've got about 20 songs and I plan to finish the additional 60-plus song concepts I have over like the next 10 weeks. I write about one song per day. And I was wondering, should I release one single weekly, just acoustic, or maybe a fully fleshed out single, full production monthly, like one EP or LP, full album, like quarterly, annually, or semi-annually? And I was wondering, should I do this? Because I don't know exactly who my fans are, but I heard my fans tend to be so much who I am, but I'm just kind of discovering who that is. And the type of music that I do or that I want to do long-term is pop, but since in my kind of order of proficiency, I'm kind of like a musicpreneur where I sing, I songwrite, I play piano, guitar, and I also play the 10-string King David harp. And I love to actually release some piano albums and just some harp albums. So I was wondering, should I only release pop music, only release acoustics, or I can do maybe acoustics, fully produced pop, and instrumentals to kind of make more money and have more opportunities out there. So again, my name is Leroy Mobley. That's LeRoyMobley. And that's LeroyMobley.com everywhere.
Kind of cut off there at the end. And it seemed like there was some technical difficulties. I'm not sure if you were hearing the call.
I could hear it all.
Okay. But so basically, Leroy has a lot of songs he's cranking out. It seems to be a trend. All you prolific people, you make me
we
sick.
All have the same problem.
And he's doing it under a lot of it's pop music. There's some that he wants to do in different genres. He's trying to decide a strategy. What do you have any? I know we've talked kind of about this a bunch in this episode already, but do you have any advice for him in his particular situation?
On the genre question, I feel like there's no rule against piano and harp being incorporated into big production pop music, for one. Like, what's the violin, dancing violin player's name that's huge on YouTube?
I know who you're talking about.
Well, you know, there's a place for all sorts of unique things to be brought into big, you know, music with big beats and big synths and all that stuff. And so I would say keep one artist identity and maybe put your foot forward with the pop stuff. But then, you know, you can find ways to put those other elements into that kind of thing so that it still feels cohesive. And then, you know, that's always been my advice when this has come up over the last like 6 months or whatever. It's just be you and do a few different things. And probably you'll realize that your audience will stick with you because ultimately you're the brain behind it all. And there's some through line there. As far as the release schedule, I don't know. It sounds like he could have almost any direction, but I'm not sure. I think if he's trying to do big pop, he also needs big promotion and big videos. So maybe putting out a song a week or even a month is too much if you're going to have to spend a lot of time on that, all that other stuff too.
Yeah, I could agree to that. And I think what you're saying about the genre stuff, I think people, a creator, while they approach music like, say, doing a classical track or a pop track, in their mind, it probably feels more different than maybe it is to the listener, because there's going to be some elements that it's just you. So it's, I mean, that how you infuse, create music and how you infuse yourself into it is going to have some overlap. So it might be best to start creating under your name. And if things are really divergent, then, you know, start branching some things out. But if you haven't really been putting the music out yet, I think it's important to just establish some sort of identity and not get too tricky with it at first, you know. That's just making.
And I also think, like, I mean, if you're just trying to compete with like Katy Perry and Taylor Swift and Dr. Luke and what, you know, like whatever is like this big, I don't know exactly how he's defining pop, but like if that's your competition, why not bring the harp in from the beginning? Because suddenly you have something that no one else does, and, you know, make it every bit as polished and huge and awesome, but with this little extra element that suddenly, like, I mean, maybe that's gimmicky, I don't know, but it sounds interesting to me. Like, I would be more likely to want to check that out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I wouldn't worry at first. I think getting some of those other like separating identities things can come later. I know we get this kind of question a lot, and you know, really, ultimately, it comes down to this. It's really a case-by-case basis. I'd have to know the music better and a little bit more about your background or what your plans are. Like, you know, what you said, Chris, like if it's really, really big pop, like pop hit type tracks you're creating, that might take a little bit more time and have a video and have a strategy that doing something once a week isn't really going to be the right approach. I'm always a fan of bundling music together. I think even though people grab songs piecemeal a lot of times, the broader package of an EP or an album provides context for them, and it feels more like a musical movement or a piece of a musical movement that they're engaging with, just the part they like. And so if you've got that ability and they're ready to go, I would do it that way and use some songs along the way to just as promotional opportunities. But I hope that helps. Thanks for the call. And if you'd like to call our podcast and leave a comment or a question, the number is 360-524-2209. You can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or go to the show notes at cdbabypodcast.com and leave comments. There's lots of interesting things happening in the music world these days to comment and discuss, so you can do so there. Whether you want to talk about fake artists or more Spotify streaming myths, or if you want to ask us a question that we answer on the show and get our feedback or advice, you can do so. And we love to hear it. So, you know, we haven't had in a while, Chris, we haven't had some good mistake stories. I always love a good mistake story.
Oh, yeah.
Especially one where someone's foot ends through a wall.
That is the most memorable mistake story from our 10 years of podcasting.
Yeah, and the fact that he had a picture of it sealed the deal is one of the best. But and there's always the story of people showing up to a field. There was one with someone up to a field and playing on a trailer bed, and I can't remember all the details. Those always are fun. So if you've got some, we love sharing them. And it just, you know.
Mistakes and mishaps and surprises.
Yeah. You know how to reach us. Do so. We'll share it on the show. And yeah, I guess that's going to bring us to the end. Don't forget to subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcatching app. And Chris, it's getting down to the wire for the DIY Musician Conference. I'm looking forward to it. And I think the live taping of the podcast we're going to be doing there is going to be a lot of fun. So hope you got a ticket because it's sold out.
I'm psyched for that. And last thing I was going to say is that I have a gig, an outdoor gig tonight, and it's a billion degrees out.
Oh, perfect. Those are my favorite.
It's so humid and so warm, and I have to play for 3 hours, I think.
You know what? That reminds me of every year in, while Small Town Poets was, you know, that was my job, touring nonstop. Every year it'd come to festival season. At the beginning of festival season, I'd think, oh, awesome. I only have to play for 45 minutes, and I get to hang out and see a bunch of my other friends' bands play, and I get to hang out with them, who we, you know, a lot of them, we were, you know, lived in the same town but never saw each other because we were always touring, and I think this is going to be so much fun. And then I'd get there, and it'd be dusty, hot, the sun, you're playing at like 6 or 7 o'clock, and the sun is just like beating down on your guitar, making it impossible for it to stay in tune. And you're sweating everywhere, and you're like, this is miserable.
You can't see if your pedals are on because yeah, the sun's on all your LEDs.
Yeah, like, you're having tuning issues, and then the sun's on the pedals, and it like turns the liquid crystal display black because it's so hot. You know, it's just like, this is miserable. I can't wait for the fall.
Plus, outdoor sound generally sucks more than it's good.
Yeah, so have fun with that.
All right, I will.
Well, that's going to do it, and we'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.